Hi, everybody. This is the seventh in our series on Joseph. It's called Judah Mans Up, coming from Genesis 44. We had a little technical problem as the sermon started, so the first minute or so wasn't recorded, so I just wanted to fill that in now. This sermon is actually told by Judah himself, who appeared on the scene in our sanctuary as the sermon started. And it started this way in Judah's words. It's now several years into the famine. The ground is dry as a cork, and no one has any food. We've eaten all the grain we had brought from Egypt. My father commanded us, "Now go get us some more food from Egypt. We're hungry. We're starving." "But we can't go down there without Benjamin," we said. "That man there warned us not to come without him." And our father got very angry. He shouted at us, "Why in the world did you tell that man that you have a younger brother?" And we said, "We didn't know. He asked us about our family, and we said we had our father, and we had our brother who died, and we had Benjamin. We didn't know he was going to force us to bring Benjamin." And there was a moment of silence. We sat around and we looked at each other. And then I decided to step up. So I said to my father, "Send the boy with me. I will guarantee his safety. If Benjamin does not come back, you can put all the blame on me for the rest of my life." And my father paused for a moment. And I saw the wrinkles in his face, very, very deep. And he said, "Okay, take your brother and go. May God Almighty bless that man so that he will release Simeon and let Benjamin go back with you. And if not," and his voice cracked a little bit, "I am bereaved. And if I'm bereaved, I'm bereaved." And I saw his eyes, and I heard his voice, and I saw the lines in his face, and something in my heart broke. So we packed up and we went back to Egypt. We took double the silver, and we took a whole bunch of gifts. And when we got there, we weren't taken to the man's office. We were taken to the man's house, and that scared us to death. We thought perhaps he was going to attack us and take us as slaves and steal our donkeys. So when we got there, we grabbed the steward as soon as we saw him, and we explained what had happened. We didn't take the silver. We don't know who did that. We don't know anything about that. And besides, we've brought back double the silver. We're really okay guys. And the steward said something strange to us. He said, "Don't be afraid. Your God did this." About noon or a little after noon, the man came home and he saw us and he asked about our father, and we told him about Jacob, that he was well. And then he asked us about Benjamin, and we pushed Benjamin out to the front, and the man looked at him and you could see that he was moved, and he put his arms around him and he put his hands on his head and he blessed him. And he stood there for a couple minutes, just touching him. And then he left. He disappeared into another room. And after a few minutes, it seemed like a long time, but it was probably only a few minutes, he came back out and he looked like he had been weeping. And then he brought us into the dining hall and served us food. We sat by ourselves over here. And he sat by himself up there. And over here were all the Egyptians. And we learned later that it was detestable for the Egyptians to eat with Hebrews. But the strangest thing of all was that he placed us brothers at table in order of age, starting with Reuben, going all the way down to Benjamin. We don't know how he did that. We tried not to drink too much, and we didn't. So our hangovers weren't too bad. We got up as early in the morning as we could, and we took off with our sacks of grain back to Jacob. And just at the end of the morning, we saw a cloud in the distance. We saw someone coming up at us very, very quickly. And as he got closer, we saw that it was the steward. And when he got to us, we saw not only that it was the steward, but that he was furious. "Why have you repaid evil for evil? A good with evil. This is a wicked thing you've done. My master's divination cup, his silver cup, the cup that he uses to know the future and to know what to do, you have stolen it." We, of course, didn't know what he was talking about. We hadn't stolen anything. Why would we? We had brought double the silver back. We were so sure of ourselves that we promised him that we would all become his slaves, all of us, including Benjamin, if he found the silver cup in a sack. And not only that, the one in whose sack the cup was would die. We were so sure, and I was so sure. So we dismounted, we took down the sacks, we opened each one, and there in Benjamin's sack was the silver cup. And my breath was gone. I couldn't breathe. This was a death sentence for Benjamin and for me. In silence, we closed the sacks, put them back on the donkeys, and took that long ride back to the city. And we got to the man's house, and he appeared. And if we thought the steward was angry, the man was furious. "What have you done? Don't you know that I can find things out by divination? Don't you know that you would not be able to hide this from me?" "What can we say?" I said, because it was turning out that I was the spokesman. No one else of those brothers dared to open his mouth. They left it to me. "What can we say? We are innocent," I said. And as soon as I said the words, "We are innocent," the image came in my head of Joseph in the well, in the cistern, 20-some years ago. And before I knew what happened, the words popped out of my mouth, "God has uncovered our guilt." That must have really puzzled the man to at one moment say, "I'm innocent," and the next moment, "God has uncovered our guilt." But then I said, and this was the best solution I could think of, "Now we are all your slaves." But the man was stern and unmovable. "No," he said, "only the man who had the cup in his sack will become my slave. The rest of you go back in peace." There was nothing I could do but stand up and take responsibility. And I knew I needed to make the speech of my life. So I came forward, I got down on my knees, I prostrated myself, and I said, "Please, Master, can I say just one thing to you? Don't get angry. Don't think I'm presumptuous. You are the same as Pharaoh as far as I'm concerned. You, Master, asked us, do you have a father and a brother? And we answered honestly, we have a father who is old and a younger brother who was born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only son left from that mother, and his father loves him more than anything. Then you told us, bring him down so I can see him. We told you, Master, that that was impossible. The boy can't leave his father. If he leaves, his father will die. And then you said, if your youngest brother doesn't come with you, you won't be allowed to see me. And when we returned to our father, we told him everything you said to us. So when our father said, go back and buy some more food, we told him flatly, we can't. The only way we can go back is if our youngest brother is with us. We aren't even allowed to see the man if our youngest brother doesn't come with us. And your servant, my father, told us, you know very well that my wife gave me two sons. One turned up missing. I concluded that he'd been ripped to pieces. I've never seen him since. If you now go and take this one and something bad happens to him, you'll put my old gray grieving head in the grave for sure. And now, can't you see, sir, that if I show up before your servant, my father, without the boy, this son, with whom his life is so bound up, the moment he realizes the boy is gone, he'll die on the spot. He'll die of grief, and we, your servants who are standing there before you, will have killed him. And that's not all. I got my father to release the boy to show him to you by promising, if I don't bring him back, I'll stand condemned before you, Father, all my life. So let me stay here as your slave, not this boy. Let the boy go back with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? Oh, don't make me go back and watch my father die in grief. I did my best to make clear to the man how much my father loved his sons, and how much I knew what pain my father had experienced, and that I was not going to allow my father to go through that pain again. I would step up. I would man up. I would take the place of Benjamin. We had promised that he who had stolen the silver would die. Benjamin had a death sentence over his head, but I would take it. I would let myself be imprisoned. I would die in his place, in order to make sure that my father did not go down to his grave in grief. Thousands of years later, this happened. I saw a strange sight. I stumbled upon a story of death and resurrection. Allow me a few minutes to share it with you. Even before dawn on Friday morning, I noticed a young man, handsome and strong, walking in the alleys of the city. He was pulling an old cart filled with clothes, and he was calling in a clear, resonant voice, "Rags! New rags for old! I'll take your tired old rags! Rags!" The air was foul in those dark streets, tainted by the filth and trash that living unleashes on the world. And yet, as the man called out, the air became tinged with a faint scent of cleanliness, as though the breeze that carried the sweet music of his voice also carried with it the promise of a cleansing rain. "Rags, new rags for old, I take your tired rags, rags!" The man continued to move through the dim light of early morning, his strong voice echoing from building to building and street to street. Now, this is a curious thing, I thought, for the man stood 6'4", and his arms were like tree limbs, hard and muscular. His eyes flashed with intelligence. What was he doing here in a city that had no need for such a useless profession? Who recycled rags anymore? Could he find no better job than this, to be a rag man in the heart of a city? Driven by my curiosity, I followed him, and I wasn't disappointed. Soon the ragman saw a woman sitting on her back porch. She was crying into a handkerchief. Her body language said it all as she seemed folded in on herself, shoulders down, back slumped forward, knees and elbows making a sad X. She had no hope. The ragman stopped his cart. Quietly, he walked to the woman and asked, "Will you give me your rag? I'll give you another." He slipped the handkerchief from her eyes and laid across her palm a linen cloth so clean and new that it shined. Then as he began to pull his cart again, the ragman did a strange thing. He put her tear-stained handkerchief to his own face and began to weep, to sob as grievously as she had done. Yet she was left behind without a tear. "This is amazing," I thought, and followed the sobbing ragman. Like a curious child who cannot turn away from a mystery, I watched the ragman from a distance. "Rags, rags, new rags for old," rang forth his voice. Though it was still strong, it also shook with emotion as he wept. "Rags, I take your old rags, rags." The sky showed gray behind the rooftops. It was light enough to make out the shredded curtains and damaged blinds that hung in dark windows. In a little while, the ragman came across a little girl whose head was wrapped in a bandage. Her eyes were blank and empty. A single line of blood ran down her cheek. Now that tall ragman looked upon this child with pity, and he drew a lively bonnet from his cart. "Give me your rag, and I'll give you mine." He loosened the bandage, removed it, and tied it to his own head. The bonnet he set on hers. Suddenly, her eyes took on an understanding and intelligence that had been missing before. She placed her hand to the side of her head where the bandage had covered the wound that was no longer there. Smiling in wonder, she watched as the ragman rose unsteadily to his feet and moved back to his cart. I gasped at what I saw, for with the bandage went the wound. Against his brown ran a darker, richer flow of his own blood. "Rags, rags, I take old rags," cried the sobbing, bleeding ragman. The sun was at its height by now, and the ragman seemed more and more in a hurry. "Do you have a job?" the ragman inquired of a man leaning against a telephone pole. "Are you crazy?" the man sneered, pulling away from the pole and revealing that the right sleeve of his jacket was empty. "So, give me your jacket, and I'll give you mine." The one-armed man took off his jacket. So did the ragman, and I trembled at what I saw. For the ragman's arms stayed in his jacket, and when the other put it on, he had two good arms, thick as tree limbs, but the ragman had only one. By now I had to run to keep up with the ragman. Though he was weeping uncontrollably and bleeding freely at the forehead, pulling the cart with one arm, stumbling with exhaustion, he still ran on ahead faster. I wept to see the change in this man. I hurt to see his sorrow. And yet I needed to see where he was going in such a hurry, perhaps to discover what drove him so. The once strong ragman was now old and frail, weeping and bleeding, staggering and falling, his body racked with pain, sorrow, and disease. I watched as he came to an old abandoned lot that was filled with piles of trash, old furniture, and the rusted out shells of cars and construction equipment. He moved among the garbage pits and piles of human refuse and finally climbed to the top of a small hill made from the trash of 1,000 lives. He struggled to pull his cart and its sad, pathetic burden. With tormented labor, he cleared a little space on that hill. With a deep sigh, he slowly made a bed from the contents of his cart and lay down on it. He pillowed his head on a handkerchief and a jacket. He covered his old aching bones with an army blanket. His body shook under the load of its injuries and pain and disease. His eyes wept, and the wound under his bandage continued to bleed. With one last deep sigh, he closed his eyes, and he died. Oh, how I cried to witness that death. I sat down in an old abandoned car and wailed and mourned as one who has no hope. I wept because I had come to love the ragman, As I had followed him, I had watched him work wonders and change lives so profoundly that it didn't seem fair that he was gone. Every other face had faded in the wonder of this man. I cried myself to sleep. I slept all the way through Saturday to Sunday. But then on Sunday morning, I was awakened by a violent light, a pure, hard, demanding light shining against my face. I looked up and I saw the last and the first wonder of all. There was the ragman folding his clothes, a scar on his face, but alive. And besides that, healthy. There was no sign of sorrow nor of age, and all the rags that he had gathered shined with cleanliness. I was in awe of the transformation, humbled by the starry state of my ordinary sameness. I lowered my head and trembled for all that I had seen. I walked into the ragman's presence. I told him my name and that I felt like a sorry figure next to him. Then I took off all my clothes, and I said with dear yearning in my voice, "Dress me. Dress all of me." He dressed me. My Lord dressed me. He dressed my feet, my body. He dressed all of me. He put new rags on me. And now I glow in the sight of the ragman, this ragman, the Christ. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man, someone might possibly, like Judah, dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were sinners, Christ died for us. I'd like to ask you to stand. I don't think we can equal the Bellevue Baptist Church. We're going to sing this song for ourselves, and I encourage you to take these words on your lips and to really think about what it might mean for you that Jesus has taken your weeping, your sorrow, your sin, your pain, your suffering, whatever it is that cripples you and makes life hard for you. He really has taken that upon himself and brings it to the Father, and you really are existentially and fundamentally free. So take these words upon yourself as we sing.